This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
This morning on The Breakfast Grill, we have Steve Keane, the Professor of Economics at Kingston University in London, and a bit of a rock star in such circles. Steve, welcome to the show. Now, you declare yourself as a bit of a prominent critic of conventional economics, mm-hmm. such as by being in favour of the UK's exit from the EU. But first, some of your details in terms of a background.
Yeah.
How does the son of a bank manager
who
spent his field of study in law and the humanities end up by being an economist?
Well, I did law at university, arts law, because what I wanted to do was economics and engineering. And there was no such combination back in those days. And I had my linguistic scales on all the various registers were off the scale, so they said do law. And law I found a rather boring waste of time, frankly. But I did economics as part of my arts degree. And then
right.
in the middle of that, I actually led a student revolt against the teaching of economics at my university in 1973.
So it was a bit of a convoluted path to where you are now. But, you know, how did your views on economics form? Were they made or as a result of where you were?
It's really an intellectual thing because mainstream economics, what everybody reads in the newspapers and all the stuff they see in textbooks, tells you that the market economy works relatively perfectly, normally lives in equilibrium, and all the disturbances are caused by governments doing bad things. And money really is irrelevant. You can ignore money, ignore credit, because money is just a veil over barter, as they say. And I believed all that stuff when I went through school in the beginning of my university, and then I had a lecturer shoot an intellectual hole right through it in first year and turning completely upside down all the arguments all the conclusions that came out of that theory without doing much different to the logic. And I thought, if you can completely invert the conclusions like that so easily, there's got to be something wrong with the theory. So I started looking around and I did a huge amount of my own research in this. The only person who really made sense in putting it all together was Hyman Minsky.
Right, and of course, as well as Irving Fisher. Now, Hyman Minsky believes in the financial instability hypothesis, and Irving Fisher in the debt deflation theory, essentially that private debt, the accumulation of private debt, is the reasons why crises occur.
Fundamentally, and that's the big difference with mainstream economics. If you read somebody like Paul Krugman, he'll tell you that debt doesn't really matter except during a financial crisis when it means that people, when the interest rate falls below zero. So they think only in the circumstances that exist now do you need to worry about debt. Most of the time you can ignore it. And that really says that fundamentally we're just bartering with each other and there's no role for debt. Just indicates how much I owe you. And if you're in debt and I'm not in debt, and if you pay your debt down, I've got more spending power. One person paying off their debt lets somebody else have more spending power. It's like on a seesaw. The average height of the two remains the same. Okay, one might be up, one might be down, but there's no change in the actual height of the seesaw. That's the vision they have of the role of credit. Now, that was Minsky just rejected that, and the whole tradition, which he calls post-Keynesian economics, he was part of, a critic of mainstream thinking about how Keynes actually wrote. But the most important part for me was what Fisher spoke about, which is the role of debt. And he said this is going to sound rather sexist in the modern generation, but he said a man-to-man debt you can ignore, okay? But a bank debt is different because man-to-man debt, the one person who lends has less spending power, the person who borrows got more, and that's the seesaw effect. But when you borrow from a bank, the bank actually creates the money just by double-entry bookkeeping. It says, great idea, here's €1 million. By the way, you owe us €1 million. And that actually creates money and creates debt and creates spending power all at once. And that can give you a boom when the debt level's rising. When you get an excessive level of debt, and Malaysia's there again, the borrowing stops and the actual level of total spending falls.
Okay, so conventionally economists discount, I guess, to some degree, this whole notion of debt and credit. And I find that astounding because when you borrow too much money and you spend all your disposable income paying off your debts, then obviously you're not going to be consuming anymore. You're not going to be demanding anymore.
Yeah.
And therefore, the things slow. And you multiply that by the population of a country.
It's huge.
Well, exactly.
Yeah.
So why is it that conventional economists discount the notion of credit?
Well, they began from look where they originated. They were arguing against Marx back in the 19th century. And they were trying to say Marx is saying capitalism is going to fall apart. We are developing an alternative saying capitalism is a perfect system. This is back the 1870s. And we want to prove that it's perfect. But that's really difficult given the mathematics we have in the 19th century. So we're going to make a few simplifying assumptions. Let's ignore money. Okay? Let's ignore credit. Let's ignore disequilibrium. and then do mathematical modeling that fits in all that. As it happens, the mathematical modeling they did didn't prove what they wanted to prove anyway. It took 30 years to establish that by mathematicians. But they were so hung up on this idea of a market economy reaching equilibrium that that became the mindset they've been stuck in for 1.5 centuries without actually realizing it. And as part of that, they had to ignore money. Now, they've got to the stage where they think you can analyze capitalism while ignoring banks, debt, and money. And I think that is wrong for a start. But because it was based on technology we had in the 19th century, the mathematical technology, doing it in the 21st century, when we have the mathematical technology to model non-equilibrium systems, build models of credit and money, to continue ignoring it is intellectually criminal, fundamentally. And I'm saying you can model it, and when you do, you can explain the 97 Asian financial crisis, you can explain 2007, and you can also say why I think a number of countries, including Malaysia, are close to having another financial crisis right now.
Okay, so a distinction needs to be drawn, because debt takes a few different forms. And, of course, you know, you've got public sector debt, which is government debt, and then you've got private sector debt, which is, you know, household debt as well as corporate debt.
Yeah.
And you point out that it's the private debt side which should be concerning, because in Malaysia, we make a big song and dance about household debt being somewhere around about 91% of GDP. But when combined with corporate debt, that's about 150% of GDP, which is obviously, you know, reaching untenable levels.
That's the danger level. And this is what I've – and that's just my work. I'm also going by an American philanthropist with the unusual name of Richard Vague.
Right.
Anything but Vague.
Fantastic name for an
economist. He's not Vague, believe me. Like a bit like the boy named Sue. You know, you're the most masculine man you can imagine. Richard established two of America's major credit card companies. He's a billionaire. He won't tell me what he's actually worth. But he became worried about his own customers in the credit card business back in the early 2000s because of the level of mortgage debt. And he was showing all these charts about the level of private debt and saying, you know, can people actually support this? And economists would tell him, don't worry about it. It's unimportant. You know, one person's assets, another person's liability. That's the seesaw argument. And he finally had Barclays Bank, as it happens, chief economist, said to him when he was making his case about the level of private debt in America, the guy said, yes, okay, that's they've got a lot of private debt, but they've also got a lot of private assets, and that's about a trade I'd take any day, at which point Richard sold his company to Barclays 2 years before the financial crisis.
Well, that's a bit rich because, you know, if you're the reason behind so much debt in the first place, then why are you against it?
Nonetheless, he's now a campaigner against it. He has a thing called the debteconomics.org, and he there is saying it's private debt that caused the crisis, and we're now back in the danger zone. What he identified empirically, and I've done the same thing theoretically after his empirical work, is that a country gets to be in trouble when it has a private debt level of greater than 1.5 times its GDP and when credit is growing at something at the order of 10% of GDP. That means that your change in debt, which is credit,
okay,
is about 10% of GDP.
So Malaysia's right about there because
on
a combined private side, we're about 1.5 times of GDP. And I think credit is running at about 15% of
GDP,
which is 5% higher than your safe levels.
That's right.
So what does that mean for the local economy?
What it means is that at some point, people will stop borrowing that money.
Well, you can see it already because in Malaysia, you know, loans growth is down about 6% on a blended basis, down from 15, 16, one, two, two, three, 2, 3 years ago.
Okay. Well, what that means is that is actually demand which is evaporating. Okay. And the people, if you think about your own personal situation, if you're spending based on your income plus spending based on your credit card, what mainstream economics tells you, when you add everything up, the credit card stuff out cancels out. It doesn't. That's the mistake they're making. So if you imagine your own situation, you get to the stage you're carrying those $10,000, $20,000, $30,000 I'll have to use for the debt level versus an income of, say, $10,000 or $20,000. You think, can't handle any more debt, got to stop spending. And suddenly you're no longer walking down Main Street going shopping. The demand just disappears. And that's what happened back in 97 with Malaysia. And it's going quite likely to happen in the next 2 years.
Well, that's quite concerning because it's not just Malaysia in this, you know, such a precarious position. You know, we're on the cusp of, as you say, financial collapse, but there's a whole bunch of other countries that are in huge debt situations.
Yeah.
Not sure where the private side is, but, you know, people like China, the Australians, the Swedish, the Hong Kong, the Honkies, South Koreans, Canadians, and Norwegians. So all of them are kind of like in the same, you know,
they are.
Boat.
There's about, we're not going to have a crisis in America again because they've already had their crisis. They're in the aftermath, and I call them the walking dead of debt at that stage. They they can't get. They're going to be struggling with low demand like Japan has been doing for the last quarter century. But certainly Malaysia, Singapore, Thailand, China, Sweden, Hong Kong, Australia, Korea, Canada, Belgium, Norway, they're all countries which are in that danger zone of, in their cases, often two times GDP as a debt level, higher than Malaysia, and credit being above 10% of GDP. So they're all ready for a fall.
We are talking this morning to Steve Keen, the Professor of Economics at Kingston University in London. After this, we're going to be talking about Brexit, your views on Brexit, and the distinction, I think, Steve, between government debt and private sector debt. On the grill this morning, Steve Keen, the Professor of Economics at Kingston University in London. And again, Steve, a bit of a rock star in such circles. Now, you talk about how, you know, the danger of private debt might be harming growth in the immediate term. Mm. But isn't it possible for people to just keep borrowing, just like governments are borrowing?
Governments can keep on doing it indefinitely because government is the only institution in a country that owns its own bank.
Great, but then a lot, you know,
people know.
Much has been said about the high level of household savings assets on hand and the value of such assets. Can't they just keep collateralizing?
No, they can't, because we think that savings creates spending. You know, if you save money, you then provide investment, and that enables the economy to grow. It actually works in the reverse direction. Savings is what effectively is the sum of money in our bank accounts, and that money is created by banks lending in the first place. Loans create deposits. Deposits what we call savings. So, in fact, the driving force is the level of lending by the private sector. And the thing is that can, when that's growing up, it stimulates demand, but then you get to the point where there's debt can be so high that the change in debt is a huge proportion of total demand. And if that change in debt slows down, it doesn't even have to go negative. A slowdown in that change in debt means such a drop in credit, the total demand can fall, even if GDP is still rising. And that's where we got to in the 2007 period with America. And we're now certainly there in the case of all those countries I've mentioned, China, Sweden, Hong Kong, Australia, and Korea and Canada. They're all on the point where simply debt stabilizing will cause a downturn in total demand.
So this is where here we talk about why you're here in Malaysia, Steve. You're here to speak at the World Islamic Economic Forum. And one of the things that you're going to be discussing is the whole issue of Islamic finance. And, you know, superficially at least, we believe that the Sharia finance will get us out of trouble. It's kind of like a get-out-of-jail-free card because, it dispenses with the whole issue of derivative income, dispenses with the whole issue of risk-taking. Now, you disagree. You think that Islamic finance could well be another potential time bomb in future.
Well, no, there's a whole Islamic finance. If you take it to the absolute bare bones level, it means that when a bank lends, rather than taking a debt claim on the company it's lending to, it takes an equity share in the company it's lending to. And therefore, rather than getting an interest payment based on the level of debt it creates, which is Western finance, it takes a dividend flow based on the amount of equity that it's got. Okay. And that looks better, and it's certainly at the individual level, it means the risk is being shared between the lender and the company. But the same potential problem is there, that share that they have of the company can grow even if all the borrowing is for completely legitimate purposes. If you're borrowing for speculation, of course, that's going to end up coming a cropper. But what it can mean is the level of bank ownership of the industrial sector can become overwhelming, that then the amount of money that's left for the industrial sector to invest becomes so low they stop investing and you have a slowdown in growth and an economic crisis. So it isn't you can't just rely upon the sheer Islamic finance element, that side. You've got all the other parts that go with it. You have the emphasis upon giving. You have the emphasis upon sharing the whole society. You have the idea that the giving to the poor is that's part of the philosophy as well. And you need all of those because what they end up saying is that we can't let the financial sector take over an economy. And that's really that applies whether you're talking Sharia finance or you're talking Western finance. When the finance sector is small and providing the money, and financing investment and innovation, that's good. When the finance sector becomes dominant, your economy will collapse.
Steve Keane, the Professor of Economics at Kingston University in London, with us on Grill this morning. Now, of course, I'm sure you've done your research on Malaysia. You would know that the biggest, or in fact, the most valuable company by market capitalization in Malaysia is a bank, and the government owns stakes, or in fact, substantial stakes in, I think, at least two or three, or at least four of the big five biggest banks in the country. Now, does the situation you just described become that much more complex when you've got the government in ownership of the private sector banks and the banks themselves taking big stakes in enterprise and industrials via Sharia finance, which is multiplying in value each passing year?
That is a big problem. You want your finance sector to be a servant, not a master. And the trouble is, even with Sharia finance, they can end up owning so much of the industrial sector through the equity share they take in that type of lending that they become the major actors in your society. And finance, so I had one of my students with us beautifully once, who's saying, is finance a source of profit or is finance a cost for industrial corporations? And fundamentally, it's a cost of doing business. And if you let that cost get too high, what's left over for the business to actually do the investment becomes so low that you can have a crisis.
So what's in store for the global economy? Because you just described, you know, six or seven of the world's biggest economies outside of the US, you know, with the Chinas of this world and, you know, the Malaysia, not that Malaysia's big, but the Australias of this world as
Canada
well.
Canada and so on.
And
yeah,
Canada
Sweden,
and Norway. And Norway, yeah. So, of course, in Singapore as well, you know, the Malaysian, the ASEAN economic juggernaut. Mm. So what's in store for us? Can a financial crisis, Steve, be averted or...
It can't be. We've already, just like the American one had to happen back in 2007 because their level of private debt had got to be so high and their credit levels were so. Basically, when they hit their wall, they had a private debt level of about 1.6 times GDP and the credit was 15%. Of total credit. GDP was equivalent to 15% of GDP, additional demand. And then they crunched in the crisis. Once you get in that situation, you can't avoid the slowdown of the growth of credit. You can do something to attenuate the opposite direction, which is government spending in the other direction, or the government's capacity to create money could be used to cancel the private debt. And that's what I want to see is institutionalizing. And in a sense, that is going back to the idea of jubilees.
Correct. We'll talk about the jubilee in a few minutes. But with interest rates on the way, and especially in Malaysia, I think the Bank Negara is going to cut rates by another 25 basis points by the end of the year. Mm. You know, interest rates and borrowing costs have never been lower. So the proposition to borrow even more. And we've seen in the last few months, Steve, I'm not sure if you know this, but the property developer lobby have been instrumental in getting, for example, the regulators and policymakers to delve deeper into the retirement savings, to buy properties, to borrow your down payment, to allow developers themselves to become financiers. Now, all these are hallmarks of a very strong property developer lobby. Yeah. Are we setting ourselves up for a huge almighty bang here?
You are. And letting property developers and financial institutions run your economy is a recipe for disaster ultimately.
But that's the anomaly here. Well, that's the conundrum, right? Because, Steve, in Malaysia, the government sector is at least 30 to 35% of the listed of listed markets. Mm. They have an inherent interest in making these things work for them. And they disguise it in the form of a multiplier effect.
Mm. That's the trouble. I mean, the government itself can be caught up in this whole political process. There's an area called modern monetary theory, which is a sort of parallel approach to economics, the one that I take, and they say the government can, you know, government spending can maintain full employment, et cetera, et cetera. That has a very beneficent view of the role of government. It doesn't see any self-serving behavior inside the government sector.
Well, they don't really care about the common people. They care about their own personal P&Ls,
aren't they?
That's
the trouble. When you start having that sort of thing happening, then the government can get tied up with all of this and you get a corrupt circle at the top, which adds on to the financial problems you have in the first instance.
Okay, so you've talked about this whole debt jubilee issue, right?
Yeah.
In the sense that as opposed to buying bonds and as opposed to printing more money and putting money in the hands of the bankers, you're proposing that money is being put directly into the hands of consumers and people. So people with debt, you give them money to pay off the debt. If people without debt, you just give them cash anyways, so they'll start spending. I don't see that happening.
I don't see it happening either, but I'm finding it being discussed far more often than I ever expected it would be.
Did he do it for the shock? For the shock therapy.
Well, it's a positive shock therapy as opposed to a negative shock therapy, and the idea is that you have the government. I'll backtrack a bit. The easiest thing in the world to do is make money. Now that
just
obviously
print them.
People are now. Yeah, exactly. It's actually making a profit is bloody hard. Pardon me, using a bit of Australianism there.
That's all right.
making a wage is hard. Get a job, but making money is if you are a bank or if you are a government, it is the simplest thing in the world to do. It doesn't take any effort. You don't have to save anything before you. Governments don't have to tax to spend, and banks don't have to take in deposits to lend. We've got it completely the reverse way around. Governments create money by spending more than they take back in taxes. Banks create money by lending more than they get back in repayments. It is actually simply double entry bookkeeping. It is an incredibly simple thing to do. But we then regard that as sacrosanct. Once somebody has a debt to somebody else, we treat it like a personal debt. Like if I borrow your watch to tell the time and don't return the watch to you, that debt, I'm not repaying the debt, I've robbed you. And we put that same...
Well, that's okay if you forgive me, then I'll say, oh, Steve, keep my watch, man, no worries, right?
And you won't. No, right. You'll be annoyed about me because that bastard, pardon me, that bad person, Steve Keane, robbed me of a watch.
Yeah.
So that personal element we apply to thinking about what lending from banks and lending from governments. In fact, they're simply like banks in a game of monopoly who can simply produce more of the stuff at any particular time.
So you're saying
produce too much.
So a little side here, Steve. You're saying that government debt is not to be, you know, not to be concerned about. And you know, I'm going to cite the $19.5 trillion of debt that is sitting on the U.S. government's balance sheet. You're saying no worries. It can keep ballooning.
Not a worry in the same sense that private debt is, because in private debt, whether you're a corporation or a household, you can't print your own American dollars. But the government in America does print, inverted commas, its
own American dollars. And they can keep on printing for the rest of their lives?
America can get away with it indefinitely because it's the international currency. Okay? It doesn't need to have any other form of currency apart from American dollars to buy foreign goods. The problem for any other country, including Malaysia, is that if you have a trade deficit over time, to finance that trade deficit, you're borrowing from overseas. And therefore, you need to bring in money. You don't print yourself, and that's when you start having a problem.
So this whole issue of currency debasement, it's a big issue that's been discussed ever since, you know, Richard Nixon took the dollar off the gold standard in 1972. Do you think that's a real and very real and viable proposition to move currency to a gold-backed standard?
Not a gold standard. Gold is ridiculous to use, even talk about using a commodity as the basis of money. It really has never been.
Well, it has since time immemorial been...
No, it's what it really has been is in a sense that you... It was a form of currency between countries, okay, way, way back. If you wanted to pay, England wanted to pay for Chinese goods, okay, which is the way it was back in the 19th century before they invaded.
They'd use gold.
They'd use gold, okay. And there was therefore a gold transfer between the countries, and that would stop you at some point.
The thing is with gold, you can't leverage it. You can't make derivative products on it.
But you can't create any of it. You can simply find what's on the planet.
Well, that's okay then. People just, you know, modulate their spending.
Well, the trouble is that then modulates based on whether you find or don't find gold, and you start getting prices like the Spanish and the Portuguese were destroyed by back when they had empires. I would rather go back to the idea that Keynes had, which is you create a currency for international trade, which he called the Bancor, issued by an international institution like the IMF was in 1945, and that was then the form of currency. I prefer to have that. That then gives you the limit people want to have to control domestic spending by countries which are running trade deficits.
Okay, now a couple more minutes before we go into the break, Steve. We're going to be talking about, you know, essentially systems, and you know, capitalism is what we have in most of the developed world. As you say, I think on Hard Talk, you said better than feudalism and definitely better than socialism. But is there a proposition for another kind of system? For example, the Bhutanese system, where you know it's not predicated on GDP or economic growth, but really on happiness. Should we be looking at these alternative systems?
We should, and we've got to think about the ecology as part of that as well. Definitely.
Well, more on that. You know, what's your view? Well, why doesn't more of the developed world look at this? I think Sarkozy started talking about this.
I mean, we don't actually – the reason we don't think about it is economics, as well as not having integrated money into its thinking, hasn't integrated the ecology either. It basically ignores the impact that we have by producing goods and services on the face of this planet, on the viability of the planet itself. And we're now at the point we can no longer do that.
We have with us Steve Keane, the Professor of Economics at Kingston University in London. And we're going to be coming back, Steve, after the break. And we're going to be talking about your views on Brexit. I think you were supporting the UK in terms of their exit from the Union, but really from the ASEAN perspective and how we're trying to create an economic community after this. BFM 89.9. On the grill this morning, Steve Keane, the economics professor at the Kingston University in London. Now, you're quite outspoken. I think you've gained some infamy, Steve, in worldwide circles in terms of your support of the UK's exit of the European Union. Now, let's frame your answers in the context of Asia and ASEAN's desire to have a very similar economic bloc where free flow of business and people within our 10-member ASEAN nation. What are the kind of things that Malaysia and ASEAN can learn from the Brexit?
Don't do anything like the Maastricht Treaty. That was the real horror of the European Union. When the Maastricht Treaty was signed, that was the I call that a collective suicide note by the countries of Europe back in 2000. And the reason for that is they put constraints on government spending and constraints on the level of government debt as if that's the only problem a capitalist economy can have, completely ignoring the level of private debt. And when the crisis was hit, caused by private debt, then those constraints the Maastricht Treaty imposed on government spending actually meant it was a bit like turning off an air conditioning system inside a Malaysian house. Not a good idea.
So one of the things that hurt the EU, and I think continues to hurt it, is the lack of a common fiscal policy.
Exactly.
Now, of course, you know, does ASEAN need such a thing? And, of course, do we also want a common currency?
No, you want neither. I mean, in that sense, what you want in some ways is to get economies of scale that enable you to build larger industries which can then compete on the global market. That's what you're after out of a common market. What the Europeans are trying to do is to emulate the United States of America, where they have a gigantic market and then huge companies can grow across that entire expanse, and then you can become globally dominant. The trouble is the Americans had a single currency, a single language across the entire continent, as strange as it might be, and they had fiscal policy, which meant that nobody has any idea what the trade deficit of Alabama is with California. Doesn't matter, because if somebody moves from Alabama to California, they take the government spending with them. Now, all that was not done by the European Union. And if you guys replicated that here, you'd have a similar disaster. But if you have your separate currencies and you have your separate fiscal policies and you don't constrain government spending on simply economically ignorant ideas like the Maastricht, then it can be a good concept to have that ASEAN formation.
So correct. So obviously, you know, a Laos is not the same as a Singapore, just as an Italy and Spain is not, or Greece is not the same as a Germany. Of course, the Germans benefited the most from the union and continue to benefit the most from the union. So if you want to have a kind of like an evolution of the union theory in ASEAN, can you have a system where you get all the benefits, you know, the free flow of trade and business and people without any of the luggage that comes along with
it? You can to some extent, but one of the reasons that the European Union is breaking down right now is emigration. And the reason it's breaking down is that emigration as an episodic thing, when somebody living in Indonesia decides they'd prefer to live in Malaysia or gets a job working in Hong Kong.
Well, by and large, immigration has been good. And I think maybe that distinction needs to be drawn, because between the European situation and the Asian situation, immigration, for example, has worked quite well in Malaysia, whereas we've had the first wave of Chinese and Indians who have gone on to create great
fortunes. And the same thing in Australia.
And the same thing in the US as well.
Yeah, but what's happening now in Europe is not episodic emigration, it's systemic emigration, because, and this is what Wynne Godley, one of my great heroes in economics, wrote back in 1992, looking at the design of the Maastricht Treaty. He said that you can't devalue anymore if your country gets into trouble because you have a single currency, and you're not allowed to use fiscal policy by the crazy rules of the Maastricht Treaty, and there's no taxation spending system to compensate for a decline. So he said if a region like a country like Greece or Spain gets caught in a downturn caused by a private financial crisis, there will be no escape apart from emigration as an alternative to poverty or starvation. That's quote unquote from 1992. Well, that's exactly what's happening. The reason there's so much migration going into Britain, which caused a lot of this racist backlash there in the first place, was because they're escaping the collapse of the southern European economies by moving to Europe, to England. So you can't have free movement unless you have countries which are growing economically fairly comfortably. When you have a crisis,
and at the same pace as well.
Similar pace. Okay. In that case, nobody's been driven away from Indonesia to move to Malaysia because there's a collapse in Indonesia. That's your real trouble. So if you free movement of people only works if the economies themselves are growing reasonably well. If you combine countries and enable free movement when it can be a crisis in one but not in one of the others, and that's the situation England found itself as part of the European Union after their own crisis back in 2008, then you can have that leading to the sort of breakdown they're going through in Brexit.
Exactly, which is not the situation in ASEAN, because all of us are moving at different paces and at different wealth levels. But you know, looking back at Europe, and you've had the British politely leave the Union, as you say.
Yeah.
The French might rudely exit in future. And if you're to be believed, Steve, the whole Union might dissolve in the near future.
Yeah.
So what's it going to mean for the rest of the world in terms of yet another potential global shock?
That would be a big one, because, I always So the European Union itself is an idea of bringing Europe together and stopping them fighting each other, which the Europeans have been doing for centuries, is not a bad idea. That's like a motto of a club. It's a good motto of a club. If you look at the rules of the club, it ends up having one group being, the Germans doing very nicely, thanks very much, and the rest being, I could use a lot of expressions.
Yeah, exactly.
Not doing
well.
But
not for morning radio.
Not doing well. and consequently, it actually leads to rising conflict. And now the Germans are anti the Greeks. We're not going to support the Greeks. We're not going to support the Spanish, et cetera, et cetera. But if they'd done this back in 1945 after the Second World War, not only would everybody have been willing to have the idea of a pan-European taxation and spending system, it would have been the Germans benefiting because their economy was destroyed. And it was money going from the rest of Europe and from America in particular to redevelop them. And that would have led to a sense of commonality. They didn't do it at the right time. They did it many, many years later when people no longer have that memory of the Second World War and the benefit that Germany got out of being reconstructed through the Marshall Plan and so on. That's gone. So that's now actually – you couldn't bring in what they needed to do in the first place back then.
Okay, so Steve, we've got a couple more minutes left. And let's end with, really the panacea, the resolution of our debt situation. Now, of course, your debt jubilee proposal suggests that governments should actually bail out people and, put money directly into their pockets, not into the banks. But here's the situation. The government themselves own the banks and the governments themselves own the developers. So I don't see that ever happening.
It takes a political revolt of some sort to cause that, because what has happened is the finance sector now politically dominates the economic scene and dominates the political scene as well. If you look at Eisenhower, talked about what he called the military-industrial complex. What we now have these days is the financial-politico complex. And that means that both the political powers that be and the financial system are completely wedded together, and they're therefore determining the direction of society. Now, what we really need, we have to have an industrial basis and a worker capitalist coalition in that sense, if you like, because as it happens in my modelling and I think in the real world too, when there's a crisis, it's the workers who pay for it.
Correct. So unless you have something along the lines of an Arab uprising where people have no more food on the tables and they can't afford for their loved, they can't provide for their loved ones, you're going to have that kind of political revolt. But out of all this, once the dust settles, Steve, do you think there's going to be a new monetary order along the lines of what the conspiracy theorists are proposing?
No, the conspiracy theorists have got everything wrong. They always do. They're good at identifying symptoms, lousy at identifying causes and also solutions. But I think ultimately what we need is to go back to the idea that Keynes had about a bank or for international currencies, and then we have to say that, well, money is the easiest thing to make and the easiest thing to abuse at the same time. And we need to have government capacity to create money used to cancel private debt, but not in a way that enables asset bubbles to form and not in ways that mean the finance sector finances bubbles and property speculation rather than investment and innovation. Whether we'll get there, I'm not holding my breath.
Okay. And, at a very real level, then, should Malaysians be starting to sell off their leveraged assets? How much money, how much more time do people have here? And what can the government do to really, help out, mitigate the damage potentially?
Well, Malaysia probably has about, 4 or 5 years before it has to have a crunch. Canada and Australia, I think, have got to have one in the next couple of years at that absolute outside. You guys could go further because you have a lower level of private debt, about 1.5 times GDP rather than more than 2, which is the situation for Canada, Australia, South Korea, and obviously China. What they could do is use the government's capacity to cancel debt through the modern jubilee idea I've spoken about, but they also have to stop banks lending to finance property speculation and asset speculation. And I have a range of ideas, one I call the pill for property income limited leverage, saying banks should be able to lend no more than a multiple, say 10 times the annual rental income of a property, not lending gigantic amounts compared to the rental incomes as they currently do, and stop these price bubbles forming in the first place.
Steve, hugely educational and highly informative. Thank you for spending time with us. That was Steve Keen, the Professor of Economics at Kingston University in London, UK, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.